Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Comics Fondle podcast. My name is Andrew, and my blog is comicsfondle.com.
And, I'm still trying to figure out how I am, but we'll go with Vernon today, and I'm the proprietor of the Comics Gallery of Wilmette, Illinois.
And this is our usually monthly podcast where we talk about the latest in the comics industry and the medium and all sorts of other things. And this week, or this month, we've got a big list of comics to go over.
Right, and there's actually a couple of Marvel and DC titles on them. God help us.
Hey, you must have put those on there. So.
Yeah, you know, being a retailer, you got to read it sometimes, you know, and if they're worth the time, you know, we'll mention them and see what's going on, you know. I mean, one of the things is like the schizophrenia of the DC universe these days. I mean, their utter ability to put out 80 titles a month and there's a couple of them out there with a redeeming facet for some reason. They've decided to publish a couple of books that you can actually read, which is good, you know.
Yeah.
I'll take that and run, you know. But what's the big news story this week, at least as far as retailers? I don't know if much of it has worked its way to the civilian branch. Is DC's wonderful plans for, is it April and May of next year?
Yes.
I mean,
Convergence.
What a lovely name. What a lovely name. Now let me ask you something. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, we're 3 years into the new 52. If you had a guess, how long ago did they announce their plans to move to California? Would you say it was like eventually, was it 2 years ago maybe?
It was a long time ago. Yeah, it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, a couple of years. Now, I mean, we turn around comics in a short amount of time, but DC has decided to do a April and May event called Convergence, which takes place while they're physically moving their headquarters from New York City to the West Coast. And we got this thing now where they're going to put a suspension on all of their, we're going to say about 80 titles, I think DC puts out on a monthly basis now, you know, for 2 months now, not 1 month, but 2 months. And it's going to be substituted by a weekly 9-part series called, coincidentally enough, Convergence. Was it 42-part miniseries that are going to pepper both months? Now, as a retailer, I'll go out on a limb, speaking for myself, I hate weekly comics. I mean, weekly comics are so hard to keep track of and order properly. And more often than not, you've lost a buttload of cash before you realize what you're actually selling, you know? So, but weekly comics seems to be the new nirvana of DC. They're launching quite a few of them. I mean, I guess Marvel's going to have their Wolverine go weekly next year, you know? And I'm not sure because, I think we're already burned out on weekly comics from DC, and then Marvel's going to jump on the bandwagon. But I, on one hand, as a retailer, I want to feel positive because, you know, I've got to sell something, you know. DC has a fairly good amount of space in any comic retailer's shop, and I'm just kind of concerned. I mean, we may be able to make some hash out of this. I mean, DC is capable of publishing good comics. Whether they do or not is another thing entirely.
Right.
But the whole idea of having 42-part miniseries is, I think it just scares the poops out of a lot of retailers because you really don't get any sales momentum and you're really relying on impulse purchases by customers who would normally pick it up Batman, Green Lantern, Flash, Justice League. We haven't had any creative teams announced on any of these books. So, and another thing is, well, if they fill up this roster with the usual amount of DC schmoes that have been perpetuating their books lately, it could be pretty dull. But with their announced promise that these could be characters taken from the vast library of DC's licensed characters, you know, that they haven't really explored much, maybe we'll get some curiosity. I don't know, but it seems odd that they'd like let us know like 6 months in advance. I'm not quite sure if they're trying to build momentum or scare the shit out of us, one of the two.
Well, Marvel announced their new Secret Wars, which is going to be alternate Marvel universes fighting for the first time. I mean,
wow, that sounds very non. Ooh, what's that word I'm looking for?
Sounds like something DC would do.
Yeah, it really does. I'm like, it doesn't have any kind of impact on the universe. But I'm not sure Secret Wars is actually a trademark that a lot of people think of with quality merchandise. You know?
Yeah, so it's interesting that they're both doing their multiverse things next year. Also, is DC having to put Multiversity on hold to do Convergence?
I think it's going to be done by then, or okay. pretty close. I think they said that their regular line was going to be on hiatus, but it doesn't include like their video game tie-ins or their licensed Scooby-Doo books or any of that stuff.
Okay.
Just the member. But, you know, I'm like, okay, you get somebody used to coming in buying Batman every month. Batman is their biggest seller. Now, I'm just concerned about why you take your biggest seller and put on hiatus for 2 months.
I'm just sad that they're not going to do Scooby-Doo as part of Convergence now that you said that.
I'm telling you, if you put Scooby-Doo in there and crossed him over with Super Friends, that might make an interesting two-part.
Exactly.
Series.
Somebody might want to read that.
You know, it's funny. They dangled one of the books in front of us. There's going to be a two-part Atom series with Ray Palmer's The Atom, and I guess it's spearheaded by Tom Payer.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I want to build up a lot of excitement for it, but you know, I mean, I, as a retailer, like I said, you got to sell something, you know? So I'm going to try to remain optimistic until I see DC give more details about this, but it seems like really heavy Las Vegas odds. And I'm concerned about, other companies. Let's say they announce these creative teams and it's like the usual bunch of schmoes that works on their books now. It's a ripe opportunity for other comic book companies to come in and take market share away from them for 2 months. You know what I mean? Pending more details, we really don't know what to make of it. But, you know, I mean, 2 years. They've had 2 years, you know, and I'm kind of like thinking, well, who is that? I was actually reading some of the blogs, not blogs, but, you know, what do you call that, commentary. And, you know, some of the other suggestions are pretty good about maybe just like doing – I don't know, 10 weekly series for whatever it is, 9 weeks during these two periods or something like that. That might have a little momentum. You get to build sales on one title rather than having a bunch of two-part stories. Again, I'm not sure. A lot of it's going to be contained about who the characters are and who the writers and artists are, but I'm not sure if I would have jumped the gun on that. Isn't it kind of strange, though, that DC always makes their major announcements in USA Today? Does anybody in radio land out there read USA Today? I mean, I'm sure there's a couple of them, but it doesn't seem like you're, like, pushing it out the comics thing, you know? It was kind of funny when they sent me the email. They're like, and here's the link to the USA Today article. And you go there, and the USA Today article is actually better written than the announced email they sent to us retailers, so... It's kind of like, DC's up to their old shenanigans again. I'm not sure, but we'll see what happens.
Well, now, remember before the New 52 started, they had that DC, those flashback comics with old creative teams.
What was it? Zero Month or something, was it? I forget.
I can't remember what it was called, but they had Mesner Loebs did that really nice Wonder Woman. There were some good ones in there, and...
Oh, that was kind of like a fifth week event or something.
Yeah, but it took up a whole month, as I recall, yeah.
Yeah, they had some interesting ideas. Those were a little on the pricey side. I think there was like a buck more. They were.
I think so, yeah. But, it was just the only,
well, I don't
only
know. We'll
thing in town that week.
I would like to be hideously optimistic. As a retailer, I don't want to have to make up sales, you know. Like, hey, you know what? Batman's out this week, but would you like to come over and at the other side of the store and read an issue of Tooth and Claw or something like that? You know, I mean, will that tickle your pink? I don't know. Yeah, we'll figure it out. But we got a bunch of comics to read. It's a nice stuff. It's a good month. You know, we've had a month, so let's cover some of them, shall we?
All right.
Now, interestingly enough, on your Comics Fondle podcast, or excuse me, your blog, you had a review for Birthright number 2, which I commented in email was like remarkably similar to your review of 1, or at least it reminded me of it. You know what I mean? Like, I read 1, I haven't read 2. So what makes 2 different from 1? Help me out here since I haven't read it.
Well, 2, okay, so you did read 1.
I did read 1, right.
So 2 is... The first one was the setup of this kid going missing, and then they find him at the end. The second one has the actual first setup of what the comic's going to be like. The guy, grown up, is trying to break out. He has magical powers, and I wrote in my post that it reminds you of the scene in the first Terminator movie where he's in the police station. So, it's pretty cool. It's not as good overall as the first issue, just because there's a lot of fantasy stuff. I think we've hit that period again where there's all these fantasy comics, and we're going to talk about another one of them in a second. And, you know, where I start to lose, not,
your eyes start to glaze over.
Exactly. You start to glaze over where people just start talking and you're explaining all of the vocabulary, and it's just a little bit much. And this issue has the most amount of a little bit much, I would say, as opposed to the first issue. But it's Williamson's gonna, it looks like he's gonna do flashbacks while still moving the story forward. And, you know, it's one of these new comics that feels a lot like a TV show, and that's fine.
Yeah, it's amazing how many of our shop comics that come out nowadays that we look to from the independent creators. I mean, obviously they're writing to take their scripts and their ideas over to a multi-view of media and stuff, TV, perhaps movies if they're lucky. Birthright was a decently executed first issue for me, although it really didn't have a lot of originality or a different snap to it. You know what I mean? It was kind of composed out of little ideas from here and there and sewn into this cloth. And it's kind of, for me, it was like halfway between a dark Disney movie and Terminator or something like that, you know? And I mean, I found it to be decent, perhaps not my cup of tea, because you really got to come to the table with something as far as fantasy, because, you know, we've read enough of it as younger people and whatnot. And, Birthright's not bad. I mean, if you're into fantasy and crossover with reality in today's world, we'll see where it ends up. But yeah, I wouldn't know. If you had to give it a rating, maybe 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10, or something like that. I don't know. That would be my take on it. But we're kind of getting there, you know. Like, all right, let's see what happens next. But you know, there was a slightly better executed, although I'm still trying to figure it out, was Kurt Busiek, and
yes,
who's this new artist that really blew my socks off? Benjamin Dewey. Where did they find this guy? Where has he been hiding all my life?
And why does he want to work for Image? I mean, is DC really paying that bad that they? I guess they probably are.
Yeah, I mean, this is some seriously gorgeously rendered artwork in here, and normally, anthropomorphics just bore the shit out of me, but this guy knows how to put animal heads on people's bodies and mimic their natural attributes as animals and stuff, and it's all done on this beautiful tapestry of ornamental costumes and wonderful magical landscapes. I mean, this guy uses photo reference like other people use ink and paper, and it's just a really beautiful, well, visually illustrated book. Now, the plot itself concerning, I guess, the end of a magical era involving these magical beast-like beings in their city in the air and what they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to avoid the end of the world or move into the next thing. I'm still figuring that out. But Busiek actually comes up with the goods in the first issue. You certainly don't have a problem with the bargain. It's $2.99 for 40 pages of story and art, so I can recommend it highly to people who might be curious about such things. Where it adds up, we'll have to see. But, I mean, I'd say it's worth the price of admission just for Dewey's art, you know. There's something to be said about your main character that looks like, what's his name, Spud the Wonder Dog or something like that, from the Coors Beer commercials. I mean, he looks great.
Now, back about 12 years ago, Busiek did that Aerosmith series with Carlos Pacheco.
Yes.
Yes, and he was very excited about that, so one has to wonder if fantasy's where he has sympathies. But yeah, I mean, it's a really pretty book, and it's another interesting one because the first issue is more of like the first issue is you get no sense of what the actual comic's going to be like if it's an ongoing series.
Right, exactly. You're looking through it and you read it and there's all these different characters introduced and this big like explosive moments, and it's beautifully rendered, and it has kind of a weird, like, end with one new character riding in from the horizon wondering what's next. And we're like, well, yeah, what is next? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so in a way, you get sucked into a second issue, but I don't know if there's enough meet. I mean, so far I like the main character, the dog guy. He's kind of sympathetic, you know, and he looks nice. Maybe I'm just a dog lover or something, you know, so I'm more sympathetic towards it. You gave it a B, I think, on your blog, right?
Yeah. I give everything a B.
Yeah, I mean, if it's well executed and readable, it definitely deserves a B, and I would have to say that. Although it doesn't quite have enough meat on its bones to tickle my pink, it's something worth reading. I mean, I'm curious to see where it goes, you know?
Next up is Multiversity 3, which I have yet to read, so go for it.
Well, Grant Morrison, you know, he picks up his ball and runs with it, exploring different universes. And on this particular one, he teams up with Ben Oliver, who's in a unique kind of Photoshop artist who does, like, semi-photographic, colorful wash type stuff in a realistic manner. And this time he captures a world where the second generation of superheroes after, you know, Superman, Batman, are kind of like these jaded, bored offspring of superheroes living on a safe world where you don't really see the main dudes, but you see, like, say, a scene where Kon-El and Damian, who are now the adult Superman and Batman, are just trying to find relevance in a world where they're not needed anymore. And Superman is left like these Superman robot army to protect Earth and his son and anyone else. And it has like this dystopian feel among all of them. Like they engage, just to keep themselves busy, they engage in these role-playing games that reenact their parents' super feats and big cosmic battles just to keep busy. You know what I mean? It's like Dungeons and Dragons on a big scale, you know? And it's filled with like cynicism and plot and different personalities. And while it didn't quite hit the high notes of the second issue in terms of overall completeness, I thought it was a good read. Still, miles above that horrible first issue for me. And I like seeing Grant Morrison explore worlds, especially when he disciplines himself to a structural narrative, because he is capable of it. And if he takes his time and works it out, Grant Morrison comics can be interesting because he really works personalities against one another. And Ben Oliver's art works well with this because he works hard on the likenesses and the personalities. And it was a much better book this time around. I'm still on board. What do we get? We get Pax Romana with Frank Quietly coming up next. So I'm wondering if that's going to ship on time. Hopefully all these books have been done for a while. I know Grant Morrison's not really working for DC anymore. So I think these are all like posthumous books that are already laid out and ready to go, you know?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And you know what? It was in January's previews, they've advertised a guide to the Multiversity, which is supposed to have a map of all the DC's universes.
I saw that. Yeah.
All that. They're going to hit you up for $8 for this cocksucker. But hopefully it'll be something interesting. And, you know, if you're really kind of stuck on DC's universe and you're kind of blanded out, Multiversity is somewhere to take your superhero reading habits. I think it's quality enough to get through you there.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you take over the next one because you're pretty eloquent on, was it Velvet? I think that was our next
Velvet,
one.
Yeah. So I was looking at it and then – So Velvet 8 is the second arc of Velvet, and we've been talking a while about how many problems Brubaker's been having in some ways, finding a new series. And this has actually been going on for years, if you think about it.
Well, even they said in the editorial, I think it was, that it's been something that's floating around in his and artist Steve Epting's head for a while. And you know what? It kind of... I don't, you know, and I was thinking about this from this issue because the pacing is so glacial in this book. And the book comes out about every 2.5 months, I'm thinking, not quite monthly or not quite bi-monthly, but almost there. And Mr. Epting's artwork is just stunning. I mean, but the pace of the book hurts because not a lot happens in each issue. So you wait, and there's a few scenes, but it really doesn't advance.
Exactly, and it's like an action script, and you can tell Brubaker's hoping to sell it. And
well, the gestation period, because I was thinking about when they had this idea going through their heads for several years, it's almost like when it came time to actually execute it, they decided to do it in a long, measured style. And an espionage book, or at least even a character that's an espionage agent, needs to have a little more faster pace.
The type of thing that, and some of it could be Epting. Some of it could be that Epting doesn't want to do rapid fire art.
Uh-huh.
This should be 6 issues for the whole series.
Right. Get like, the story completed.
And this is like Brubaker goes on and on and on. And that's like, we talked about that. I think the Fatale episode, we talked about that at length. He drags stuff out instead of being concise.
Yeah. And concise helps with the type of fiction he wants to write.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of funny because in the back, he introduces in the end of the issue, he introduces a character, which in the letter column, he says, well, this is a character that I've been waiting to introduce. And I'm like, well, it's 8 issues in and you're still introducing new characters that are supposedly essential to the plot. So what does this mean, that this thing's going to go on for 25, 30 issues? I mean, I don't know if the average comic reader has that much patience to go 30 issues of Velvet or 25 issues right. of Velvet. You know, not to hurt Steve Epting. I mean, his artwork is beautiful. He's very consistent. And, you know, I love what is it? You constantly forget that you're back in the 70s.
Right.
You know, if it weren't for the old cars they drive around, I really wouldn't know that we're back in the 70s. You know what I mean? I do get a kick out of those. But, you know, Velvet is a solid, solidly executed comic book, I guess, in some ways. But ultimately, not quite as satisfying as it could be, you know?
Yeah.
It just needs to be – it needs to be amped. Like, oh, the whole thing needs to be given a shot of adrenaline, you know what I mean? Maybe we could shoot a Hypo in Velvet's ass and get this plot moving a little faster. I don't know. Well, let's see. We'll move on to one of our favorite books. Is it – what's his name? Charles Soule's Letter 44
yes.
that he does with Oni, which you know what? It has its ups and downs, but I don't think I've ever been really disappointed in an issue of it, 11 issues in so far. He seems to bring something new to the table almost every issue.
Yeah, and it does seem like, and this is the one where we talked about, it seems like he is gearing up to do his own thing now. And he doesn't do story arcs. And I guess we definitely talked about this, that Brubaker's whole, like, I'm doing a story arc, it's going to be finished in the story arc, and then the truth is it never is with Brubaker, yet he still calls them story arcs in order to, this was back from when trades were getting really big.
Right.
And so Letter 44 never feels like that. Letter 44 feels like a nice, it's an ongoing, but it's a finite one.
Right, right. It feels like you're reading a book that has a beginning and an end somewhere, and you feel that he's already got it written, okay? I feel
or he's got it plotted well, because, I mean, the stuff he's doing with these characters, you need to have this plotted out to know where these guys are going, yeah.
Well, you know, and he's got a nice balance, too. I mean, he separates the book into two things, the president's dealing with everything on Earth and the conspiracy theories and his political enemies. And then you got the other half of the book, which usually deals with the 9 scientists that are sent out into outer space to find out what's going on with the aliens. And he has a nice balance. He seems to juggle, like, what, about 20 characters simultaneously?
It's a lot,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably the most ambitious thing I've ever seen from Mr. Soule.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, at times the thing gets burdened by, let me see if I can remember the artist's name somewhere along here.
Albuquerque of some kind, I believe.
Yeah, Alberto Jimenez Albuquerque. Now, he is, he's ready, almost ready for prime time. He's got a slightly cartoonier look than perhaps the plot needs. He's not quite as inventive with his scientific scenes. They have a little simplistic. He doesn't quite have the imagination. Maybe he should do some more swiping from Al Williamson or something like that. But you know what? He gets you through it, though. You know.
Now, some of it, I would say, he is ready for where Oni has been before. But he's about on par with certain Oni books, but they also have Brian Hurt working for him, so he's not on par with that by any means.
No, not even close. He's finding his way through it. And, you know, I have to commend the guy because he keeps the style simple enough to keep this book on a monthly basis. This thing ships like Cracker Jack. I mean, it never misses a deadline. So I will give him chops for that because even though he's no Steve Epting, he gets a book out every 4 weeks. And, you know, Soleil's writing carries the day. I mean, let's put it this way. If you're visually jarred, I mean, it's a little cartoonier than I like. But you know what? There's so much going on in Letter 44, and there's so many plot twists and so many unpredictable things going on. I mean, you're more of a movie guy than I am, and this is obviously set up for a movie type of plot. Does it swipe heavily from anything that you're familiar with, or is it just a nice homage type of thing?
It doesn't swipe from very much at all. The closest thing you could think of is it reminds of something like The West Wing. It's like sci-fi West Wing. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely got its roots in soap opera, you know, the interaction between the characters and the drama, yada, yada. But you know what? No one is infallible. Anyone can die. It satisfies on many different levels. I mean, you could be a fan of different genres and enjoy this book. You know what I mean? You don't have to be a science fiction. I mean, though science fiction's part of it, I think it's more about the story, you know, and it's a real fascinating story. And the president is a fascinating character. Lord knows the first lady is an interesting
character.
Yes. She's a balls-on chick, and it's pretty interesting from her. I mean, you'll never see a first lady like her in reality. Let's put it that way. Well, let's see. What's another good one we got floating around here? This is another one that's, I think, pleasantly pleased us both with its maturity levels as it goes on. Was it Lazarus issue 12?
Yes. And this was a book that I don't even think you were reading it at the start, were you?
I started it, and you know what? I thought, oh, you know, it's kind of a cool pseudo Romeo Juliet story between two. I'll call them Lazari from different planets on a post kind of semi-apocalyptic Earth. But it's developed into something very different as time has gone on.
I know.
And, you know, it's just like a really good meal, you know, that gets better as you eat it. You know what I mean? Like a good steak as you start, you're working your way through it and you discover different flavors and seasonings and different plot lines. And I don't know if Michael Lark, he's perfect for the book, the realism he brings to it and the action scenes and stuff. And in some ways, I was kind of worried about schizophrenia because he kept diverting the plot in different directions. Maybe it's like Mr. Rucka is discovering the book in its direction as he goes along, much in the same way we are, you know. But he hasn't disappointed yet, you know. Not too bad.
It's been a really impressive book. And it's gotten that way. It certainly didn't impress me at the start. And I was reading it for the Michael Lark. But now... Rucka's, I think the second arc where he sort of shows the first arc, it was so much setup that he's now gotten to the point where he's more comfortable just telling stories, and that's really working out for the book. And I think I said in my last post, it's now, I'm shocked that it's one of the comics that when it comes out that week, it's the first one I read that week.
Right. It develops so nicely. You're right. The first arc, you know, in the soap opera tension between the inbred family or whatever it is that runs the clan that forever belongs to, and it's really developed into a nice piece of work. And I hope that he can able to maintain the momentum because we do have to come again. We're in issue 12, and it's got to come to some type of not necessarily conclusion. But, you know, we have to start wrapping up some of the stuff as we go along. He's introduced, like, a lot of plot threads, and I'm hoping to see it, you know, resonate as far as, like, concluding some of them is concerned.
I think it's interesting. I mean, we've been talking about this a little bit with these books that we don't think of an indie comic book as a true ongoing series.
No, you're right. And if this were Batman, we wouldn't be asking these questions of the book at all.
Right.
I mean... You know, like soap opera and continued characters are just part of mainstream character or mainstream comics, and you just go along with it. But with the Lazarus, you're right. I mean, this this, I was, you're right. We think of this as like a limited series just because Image publishes it and it's an independent type of comic, but, there's no reason this couldn't be an ongoing. He just has to be able to maintain the interesting characters and situations they're in.
Right.
I like the introduction of that, the big German Lazarus woman or whatever it was from that one clan, Northern Europe, I'll call it. It's kind of funny how he doesn't stereotype, but they kind of remind you of the areas they come from, as it were, you know?
Right.
And there's a lot of intrigue in Lazarus. It's definitely better than your average mainstream comic book. You know, I dig the characters and, you know, I'm along for the ride. That's for sure. Yeah.
Next up is this the first of the new Batgirl or the second?
Yes. No, it's the first one. The second one hasn't come out yet. Batgirl 35 is the one we've
played. Okay. So this is the big relaunch of Batgirl.
And the hope of DC publishing a title we can read, at least for a little bit, anyway, you know. I thought at first the market for this book would be like young ladies or something like that, but the mature themes definitely throw that off as you go through it. And yeah. Cameron Stewart does a nice reboot of the series. Batgirl's an interesting character, and his structural narrative, I don't know if he's going to be doing layouts for all the rest of the issues. That seems like a bit of a chore for someone of Cameron Stewart's stardom. I think he's probably going to let the young lady, I don't have a copy of it. I can't remember her name off the top of my head.
What was her name? Hold on, here we go.
Yeah, she's somebody I've never heard of. She does a pretty good job. It's a cartoony style, but it fits Batgirl. Babs Tarr. Yeah, it's a very, like, deceptively mature reader's book, and I liked portions of it because the villain is contemporary, the situation of crimes is contemporary, and Batgirl uses deductive powers. She actually is a detective somewhat in this,
yeah, you know,
which is something that's been missing in Batman for years now with all the Sturm and Drang going on over there. And, you know, what do you call that? Finishing up a plot line in one issue is almost like a lost art form these days, but it was a nice first issue. One hopes that it's not just a pitch and the rest of the issues perform likewise, you know?
Right.
And, you know, treading with DC, I'm really not sure, but we'll find out, you know. But nice stuff from them. That was definitely one worth picking up. We'll see. I'm curious. I'll definitely read the second issue of that one. Now, did you ever get around to reading 13 Coins?
I have not yet.
It's a toughie. It's one of those English books from Titan that, like, is really late. And it's like Simon Beisley. He gets a lot of fan press because he draws, like, cool drawings that look good and stuff like that. And I don't know. I really didn't see much in the way of original ideas or intricate plot. And he's obviously using Photoshop now to paint his panels, and that slows him down a bit. It's not as messy. It's your standard angels versus devils thing. And I don't know. It's a bald-assed media ploy, you know what I mean? And I'm really not sure it's something I'm going to pick up a second issue of. But it looks pretty. You know, he draws hot-looking chicks in tube tops with impossible anatomies quite well. Nifty guns, you know. And death and destruction. But that's what Simon Beisley is known for. I don't know. You know, it's kind of funny because British comics always look great, but they always have like these most vapid, reconstructed, reconstituted, simplistic plots that used to drive me nuts. You know, it's like you read one Judge Dredd story. Say you've read 15 Judge Dredd stories. You pretty much read the whole fucking thing right there. You really don't need to read too many English comics to get the plot. You know, it's more like, what's that? Shampoo, rinse, lather, repeat. We just move on, you know? Okay, well, that was that. God, I'm doing all the talking tonight because I see another one you probably haven't read.
I haven't read Father's Day yet either.
That is another, I'll say, media tie-in from, is it Mike Richardson, who's like one of the big kahunas? And it is pretty much a well-executed media media type of plot where you could see this turning into a really nice TV show, or it's actually a movie. It's a 4-issue miniseries from Dark Horse about a professional killer and is reuniting with his daughter in the most unusual of circumstances. And, you know, the chase and the death and the firing and all that kind of stuff. There really isn't a lot of new ideas in Father's Day. I'd have to say it's nicely executed though. And the artwork by Gabriel Guzman is very like solid and stuff like that. And, you know, I think it works on a professional adventure type of book. If you're into that thing, I think it's nicely executed.
Right.
That's all I can tell you. But, you know, it's kind of funny. I mean, they're all right. You know, it's funny. These books are still better than Marvel and DC Comics because I can't even read those fucking things. I had a customer ask me about what is their latest event comic, Axis, right? And I had to be honest with them. I go, you know, I hate to say it, but I don't read a whole lot of Marvel tales. So when they do event comics, it's like filled with characters that I'm really not familiar with. And I don't know, like, their latest, I don't know, whatever it is, their love interests or who they've killed or what they've been involved with. And it's almost impenetrable. Now, I read a lot of comics, and I just can't find it in myself to read Axis, you know. And it's tough when you're a comics retailer, you know, and you look at the customer and you're like, you know, I'd really like to read it, but I really can't. I'm really sorry, you know. I feel guilty, you know, but not too guilty. Not guilty enough to read it. Let's put it that way. I'm going to let you have Starlight number
five. Yeah, so now Starlight, is it five or six? We're talking about the last one.
Hey, I'm going to go with five or six, whatever the last one is. Well, you know, I can look it up right here. It is six. You are correct.
So now Starlight, if you're not familiar with the book, is Mark Miller's nowhere near as popular as he once was. Is Mark Miller's, it's Flash Gordon. To the point that I think they wanted to use Flash Gordon and Dynamite told them no. And they like tried to do a public domain argument and it didn't happen or something.
Okay.
So it's Flash Gordon as an old man going back to Mongo. And, or is it Buck Rogers? It's Flash Gordon.
It's Flash Gordon, yeah.
Well, it's been a rough comic.
You know, there's not a lot of original ideas.
And then you get to this last issue, and Miller delivers this fantastic, most sentimental, manipulative comic you can imagine. And it's great.
It's tailor-made for a two-hour movie.
It really just shows you that Miller knows how to do it and that he knows how to set something up okay, but he really knows how to bring it home, and he doesn't know what the hell to do in the middle.
Right.
So,
right.
I'm upset with myself for how much I enjoy this comic.
Right, because like in the middle of it, you're like, you're going through the paces, and Goran Parlov certainly gets his kudos for his
He does a great job.
Mobius imitation all the way through here, you know. He manages to straddle heavy metal and Flash Gordon and everything, and bring in Dragon Ball Z type hairstyles for the youthful protagonist sidekick, and it's really weird how Mark Millar, he can drive you nuts with his total lack of originality in creating things. But he gets the idea of what a basic plot needs to have to make it successful, you know? And ultimately, that's why I think you and I feel guilty about enjoying some of this stuff. We don't see that in a lot of more sophisticated writers sometimes, you know?
Exactly. And I mean, I still have the fond memories, and I reinvigorated those fond memories of Mark Miller's Swamp Thing that nobody remembers, and you don't have that. So, it's very strange to me that he is so successful when he tries to be. And we saw that. We see that with at least a couple of the Miller World books every time he does this. I mean, the remember the Jesus one that he did?
Oh, my God, I hated that thing.
The first issue was pretty awesome,
right? But with the other two, it was a pull the rug out from under your thing. You know what I mean?
Well, fine. Chosen was what it was called. So you know, in that one, he did a good first issue. Couldn't do anything else, and
yeah.
He just does not have. He's not consistent enough.
Well, I'm kind of trying to figure out how he's going to finish up MPH, because he makes this really weird sidestep, which you're not quite sure why he does at the end of the last issue, where the the kid runs fast enough to run to do a flash and end up back in time. And I'm like, why the hell are we here? You know, because it doesn't advance the plot. It just kind of makes it go to a roaring thud at the end of the issue. And you're like, well, my God, we have to finish this up, what, in an issue or two, right? Because I don't think it's another miniseries. And Mark Millar can just be maddeningly undisciplined in one ways, and then but he still understands what it does. I mean, in some ways, I enjoy some of Mark Millar's comics better than I do Ed Brubaker's, and Ed Brubaker's a better writer, you know? So go figure, kids. You know?
That's a good point. Yeah. All right. Okay, so speaking of problematic middle issues, we have War Stories 2 by Garth Ennis.
Garth Ennis, the
and some bad artist, some really cheap bad artist.
Well, it's Avatar. I mean, they hire the best of the cheapest. What can I tell you? I mean, this guy Matt Martin again. Another
Somebody else did the second issue.
Really? Is that why all the facial things are off as bad as they are? Okay, yep. I was wondering. The dining room scene with the guy eating a dinner over at the lady's house, I'm like, oh, my God, some of these panels are so horrendously drawn. But again,
Keith
this is
Burns,
Avatar.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that's to get it out monthly. I don't know. Garth Ennis, quite possibly the best war writer of this generation. The guy just breathes romantic war stories of hopeless tragedy and unfulfilled love and death and manglement and impairment. But, you know, War Stories is strangely unsatisfying as a story, I guess. They're vignettes, I'd say.
Every once in a while, he has this happen. He had this happen with whatever the last war... What was the last one called?
Ooh.
At IDW. At Dynamite.
Yeah, that... Fuck.
Battlefields... Something?
Yeah, well, that was the title. It was called Battlefields, and it did these three-issue arcs.
Had a couple where, you know, he had a weak second issue. I don't know if he had any that were this weak. The problem is that he's got the story, the first arc in War Stories, which is this going to be an ongoing, or?
No, I think it's going to be doing the same three-issue thing. Shorties, okay. You know.
But... It's about an American
pilot
in the UK doing bomb runs.
Right.
And by the second issue, he is doing actual runs because he never gets up in the first issue. But Ennis spends more time establishing this really unfulfilling story arc about him and a British widow.
And you can't see it going anywhere.
And I mean, like, oh, I bet the guy's going to die and the kid's going to cry. Like, who cares? You know, right. Like.
Well, you know that the British widow is going to cry.
Yeah, she's going to cry and the kid will finally cry and it'll be like he was crying for his dad or something. And it's just like, okay, what, you know.
Yeah, let's double
do something better here,
kill
you know.
Two father figures, you know. I mean, you know, and the artists on the book seem to be chosen for their. Slavish detailed drawings of World War II aircraft.
Yes, I noticed that too. To the point that it's practically unintelligible.
Yeah,
the battle scenes are unintelligible. I cannot.
Right. You know. I'm going to say right now that airfield battle scenes are very hard to do.
I can't even imagine how you would do them in a comic. I don't think I've ever seen a comic where I've been like, "That looked great."
There's not too many. I mean, there's Alex Toth. And who was another guy that could draw some George Evans, and these were guys that loved airplanes, and they were cinematic in their approach, and they could do panel-to-panel narratives of airplanes, you know, in a dogfight, and you could understand what's going on. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Instead, we kind of have to rely on Garth Ennis's narrative to carry it through. While you got these big bombastic images of death and destruction in the air, I mean, you don't really get this feel of a dogfight or a mission run. And it's more like if we're reading this guy's diary when he's like 10 years down the line of these disparate images of his life that are just kind of flowing together without a real solid structural narrative to him. But I hate to say it, but I'm such a Garth Ennis whore. I'll probably just continue.
Oh, yeah. I mean, who cares, you know? Of course, we'll stick with it.
Right, exactly. I mean, Garth Ennis is just one of those guys that goes up, goes down. And you know what? He's probably the best war writer of his generation, but nobody reads fucking war stories. And I hate to see him, like, fail miserably financially time after time after time. I mean, right now he's at Avatar, where they don't pay anybody to draw things. And if there's one thing that really needs good artwork, it's a war story, because it loses its convincing reality if the artist can't depict, I don't know, a narrative of war. I mean, war comics are very different from superheroes, because you can get away, you can fudge a lot of shit with superheroes, but you really can't fudge violent, realistic action. It either makes sense or it doesn't, you know, and you don't expect sense out of superheroes kicking the crap out of each other, because it's all fictional nonsense anyway, you know. But I got to read war stories. You're right, it's very problematic, you know. Avatar, you gotta love them as a company, you know. I swear to God, they get some talented people, but they do the best they can. But sometimes the best they can just falls short. Here's one that you missed, unfortunately, because there's nobody scanning copies of Hugh Howey's Wool. Well, I mean, it's from some really obscure label called Cryptozoic Press, and. I, you know what? If I don't order these fucking things on my master order of previews, I'm not going to get them.
Right.
And if you don't get them, how the fuck are you going to sell them? I mean, I missed issue 3. Diamond shorted me 3. So I have to go online to an online comic store to get this fucking thing. What the hell sense does that make? Okay, but nonetheless, it's going to be released as a trade, I think, before too long. But apparently, Hugh Howey writes science fiction, and this is based on a novel of his called Wool, post-apocalyptic work, where people live in silos, but they're isolated from one another, and it concerns this one young lady who is a tech and who is suspicious of her superiors and their slavish kind of mind comp attitude towards the silo, and she starts asking questions, and it's a great, I mean, you know, was it Jimmy Palmiotti and Mick Gray? They're like the great packagers. I'll call them the Joe Simon and Jack Kirby of our era, because they package comics and they sell them to various publishers, DC, and they're doing, was it Harley Quinn with his wife Amanda Connor now, but they've done a lot of stuff, you know what I mean? Most notably the Jonah Hex series that just recently ran its run, and they've had some ups and downs. But you know what? These guys know what a good constructed comic is. And they pull in, what was it? He's an English artist. I think it's Jeremy Broxton, whose artwork I last saw in the Knight and Squire miniseries from DC a couple years back. And this guy's artwork is balls on. His depictions of the technical invitations and the silos and their life and their the claustrophobic environment they live in. And it just finished up the 6th issue, and it's actually a pretty good dystopian science fiction story, if you can find it.
And now, that is actually going to be Justin Gray, not Mick Gray.
Oh, Justin Gray.
Mick Gray was somebody else who I think did art for something else.
That's right. He was an inker for J.H. Williams back in the day on Chase and all those. Yes. Okay, so Palmiotti and Gray are I'm a little off on that one. But you know what? That's a good comic. I mean, 6 issues of Wool. You know, it's got these gorgeous Cameron Stewart comics.
I see. Kind of I'm looking at it right now. It is some gorgeous art, and it's from Jet City. Who knows who they are? But they're making a big deal about how you can get it on Amazon now digitally.
Oh, wonderful. Well, hopefully somebody will read it, because it sure is. Your local comic shop is not going to be able to order it. Apparently, Cryptozoic Press only prints like 12 copies of every issue or whatever the fuck it is. So your dealer can't order it. I mean, I'm a dealer, and if I can't get it, you certainly fucked on that one. But you look for the trade. Ask your dealer. I think it's in the latest previews catalog. So check with your retailer and say, could you please order me this? I want to read it, you know? I've heard so many nice things about it on my favorite comic podcast, for Christ's sakes.
Right, now, this next one here, I have not read, so you're going to have to run with it.
I'm telling you, it's going to be one of those weeks where I do a lot of talking.
Oh, hush.
All right. Well, anyway, again, one of those rare readable comics finished up its run. Brian Azzarello and, is it Cliff Chiang's Wonder Woman?
Yeah.
Finished their run up with issue, it's either 35 or 36. I think it's 35. And I have to say that it was a pretty good run of Wonder Woman comics, probably some of the better ones of the modern era. I think although I have problems with Cliff Chang's figure drawing, he's a little graphic oriented. His figures are a little stiff, but I will give him kudos for his visual reinterpretations of Greek gods. I will give Brian Azzarello credit for the setup. I think it's a series that has more kudos in its isolated moments than its totality as a whole, but it finished satisfactorily for me. And if you're a Wonder Woman fan, I think you could do far worse than read this series. I think it's going to be available in a total of 4 or 5 trades eventually from DC. But nice stuff. I mean, it worked out all right. Much better than the usual DC crap. Let's put it that way. All right, I'm going to let you have Captain Victory because that one I didn't read.
You didn't read Captain Victory 3. So Captain Victory is... We were talking about this a couple months ago because of Night World, right? We had a couple Kirby-esque things coming out. Of course, yeah, Captain Victory is Nathan Fox. And some Farrell Dalrymple in there and some Jim Mofford. Joe Casey writes it. In a lot of ways, it's exactly what you expect from Joe Casey. It's good to see, I guess, that he's still able to do the Joe Casey thing that he's been doing for so long now.
Yeah, he's like Peter Milligan. Like, half of his stuff really interests me, and the other half just annoys the shit out of me.
But Captain Victory is... We were saying earlier that sometimes you get too much information in fantasy comics, and Captain Victory, you get a little bit too much information in sci-fi comics.
I guess so, yeah. Rather than showing, they tell. And Nathan Fox, as beautiful as his illustrative manner is, gets into a lot of trouble because he almost over-renders panels a little bit sometimes and slows the narrative down while you're trying to figure things out, you know?
Right.
And he's aided in certain periods by, on this particular issue, every issue has a different indie artist on it. And Farrell Dalrymple, I think I'm probably mangling his poor name, he's one of the greats in independent comics, and he does a little chunk of the story in here. How is the narrative holding up after 3 issues so far?
It's not as confused as I thought it'd be right now. I think it would it'd be nice to know how far Dynamite wants to take this, how many issues.
I think it's a mini. I don't think it's going more than 6 or 7 or something.
It's going to be hard at 6 or 7 because Joe Casey's bringing in science in the modern world and stuff. So,
well, he's got like 3 clones of Captain Victory.
Yeah, so who knows where that's going to go. But it's a lot better than I thought it would be. I just looked and I gave the first one a B-.
Uh-huh.
And and it sort of has turned around quite a bit.
Oh, okay.
So
difficult structure, yeah. I'm a fan of Nathan Fox. I just wish he would simplify his artwork a little more so that the narrative would be not so difficult to. Sometimes his artwork, his panels look like abstract paintings. You know, he gets really enthusiastic with the line work, and he's like a. He's got that heavy inky brush thing going like Paul Pope does, although he's a little more tighter and structured than Pope. But again, Pope knows when to quit drawing. Well, that's how it is. You got to know when to quit drawing.
It's a good way of putting it. Paul Pope sometimes knows, and sometimes you got to quit drawing.
Right. You got to say, okay, I'm done. Let's move on. You know, but he keeps working and working and working and rendering, and all of a sudden you got this big inky black mess in some of these panels, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. But... you know, again, these books are still miles ahead of most pablum from Marvel and DC, so Captain Victory could work for you. I'm going to let you have Pop 3. I've read it, but I'm going to let you have it.
So you're going to let me have Pop 3 here. Now, I thought you said that I was barely talking this episode, and it seems like I'm talking quite a bit. Pop 3 is the issue of Pop where I think I'm jumping off with one left to go. Pop started as this really good, interesting book about pop stars like Taylor Swift being grown in a tube,
manufactured
manufactured in some sort of a pod, and you know, created to be a pop star and things like that. And the second issue introduced the assassins after them. And the third issue basically just runs with the conspiracy and the assassins, with the protagonists getting, I think, two scenes. And yeah, they're crappy scenes. And I like Jason Copeland's art, but...
Right. It seems like it's a more of an ambitious project than the... than the talent level exhibited with the writer. You know, I mean, they're kind of in over their heads. They had these, like, really nice ideas, but the execution falls a little short. I mean, like you say, Jason Copeland, he's got some interesting things going in his artwork, and he could turn into a decent talent given time, you know. I'm not sure about the concept. We'll have to see. Like, I'm going to finish it off. It's only four issues, and... Well, you know, you get three in, and I'm like, I'm so...
I know, it's kind of the thing. You get to three, and you're just like, well, crap, I better finish it.
Yeah, I got to finish this. I mean, because it had enough to keep me going anyway, you know. And then I don't know. What'd you have to see? I like portions of Pop, and I recommend it at the shop. But, yeah, that third issue was a tough one because... Yeah, you only got four issues to do something. You got to get off your ass.
Right.
And get the plot.
And that's kind of the thing is like, yeah, this is not going as fast as it needs to for a four-issue miniseries.
Right. He dwells on the main character who's a bit of a loser trying to figure out whether he wants to continue on with his life. You know what I mean? And you're like, well, you've been running with this Taylor Swift wannabe chick. I assume that you want to live, you know, I mean, that... So what's with the setup there, you know? But it's almost there. Would this book have helped with a better editor? I'm not sure. We keep talking about that. And you know what? The editor is a guy named Dave Marshall who's been around for a while, I think, you know?
Yeah, so, but he's at Dark Horse, so his job is to make sure the art gets in, you know?
It could be. Dark Horse has some standards, but it's better when the creators are more mature and can handle the reins on the horse themselves rather than having the editor lead them around.
Right.
All right. Well, and the only reason the next one on our list, Dark Gods, is on this list because it's an utter piece of Avatar disgusting shit. And I think I've pretty much written off Justin Jordan as a writer. He's the guy who started off okay on Luther Strode and... really never proved to me he had much talent as he started writing other things. And Dark Gods is just a real sad, sad, derivative, lack of idea, 22 or 20 page thing drawn by German Aramus B or whatever the fuck the latest Ford import is from Avatar. And I hate it when books sell on the names of their creators and they just suck. I mean, the cover's better than the book, and it should be because, you know, that rule, don't judge a book by its cover. I mean, that was obviously made for comic books. But, you know, there's just nothing to recommend this book. Absolutely. I mean, other than the fact that it's got Justin Jordan's name on the cover, I don't know where it's going to go. So take a pass. Ugh. Hey, we got a charming piece of English work, which we've been able to look at, coming up, and you've even liked it.
Sally of the Wasteland. Now, it's an English piece of work, but I think Victor Gishler is in the States. But yeah, was it 2000 AD, or is it just from Titan?
It's Titan.
Yeah, it's still a nice, solid issue. It's got one more to go. It's... Gishler, you know, we were really excited by a couple of his series last year, Clown Fatale and the one with the
right.
Vampires and werewolves, and he just delivers a good comic.
Yes.
And this one's kind of crazy. I just remembered this one because the narrative, he really speeds it up at times and slows it down, but it seems like he's getting really set up for the finish, and I'm hoping he does a nice final issue.
No, after four issues of this roller coaster ride of this utterly likable hillbilly girl named Sally who has to survive in post-apocalyptic New Orleans with mutants and dream monsters, and all the while lusting after her idiot savant boyfriend all the way through it. And it's not what you call high concept stuff, but the execution of Gishler and artist Tazio Beton.
Yeah.
It's just, it's what you call a great fucking guilty pleasure.
I mean, really hope that the trade includes all of that back matter that they do on that book.
Oh, really? I really hadn't familiarized myself
with it. Well, I haven't been reading it, but they do put their time into, like, an amusing bit of back matter on it.
Oh, yeah. Captain Sam's Funtime Swamp Trivia. Oh, yeah. This is great. You know, and it's just one of those great little pauses that refreshes, because Sally is a very unique voice.
Yes, and she's been an awesome character, yeah.
He really has, you know, and one could say it's a sexist piece of crap in some ways, but in other ways, Sally transcends her humble origins as a piece of eye candy to be a good protagonist in the book. And she's a real simple person who has simple motives, you know. I mean, all during this Sturm und Drang about trying to stay alive, she still loves Todd. And it's just ridiculous stuff, but it works, you know. And I pray to God issue 5 finishes off.
Because this guy, Mitchler,
is fun to read. Why isn't he working for Marvel and DC?
He was writing X-Men.
Oh, my God. Oh, poor guy.
He was writing,
what was it? Victor Gishler. Yeah, we've read his stuff before. I know
he wrote a bunch of Deadpool for him. He wrote 29 issues of X-Men.
Oh my gosh.
He wrote some Punisher. He wrote Shadow after Garth Ennis left. We should check those out.
Yeah. Because I mean, I'm sympathetic to the Shadow, and I'm sympathetic.
He wrote that noir series that I didn't like.
Huh.
So
okay.
maybe that stuff isn't right for it, but it was Kiss Me Satan and Clown Fatale that were so good.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like he knows how to write a good B trashy Roger Corman movie. You know, if you like good B movie trash cinema, Victor Gishler is someone you should really be looking for, because Sally of the Wasteland is fun. Hopefully, we'll get that collected in trade form before too long as well. All right, now we're going to have a couple of turkeys here at the end, and I'm going to take some shit from customers on this, because this is an enormously popular book at my store, and it's just rubbing me the wrong way. Wicked and Divine, and I know you gave up on it, and we can continue from that, because I don't think issue five develops the plot enough that we're not going to be on the same page about this thing.
I mean,
the premise was interesting, but
yeah,
it didn't really follow through. I mean, how do you say, okay, there's these nine gods or whatever it is, and they come to Earth every few years, and they inhabit the bodies of humans and live for 6 months or whatever it is. But it's so precious and self-referential that you don't like any of the characters. And I don't even like the protagonist, who's like a groupie to Lucifer. I mean, it's very precious, and I don't know. It's rubbing me the wrong way, baby. I don't like the gods. I don't like their what would you call it? We haven't quite answered why they come back. You know,
it's like they're cursed to. And how many issues is this going to run? Like,
I hope it ain't too many, because I'm gone, baby. I mean, I don't know. I'd like to like this book, because it looks so nice. I mean. You know, what's his name? McKelvey. He does some really nice, precise, crisp artwork. And he's a decent narrative guy. But I can't get over the gods themselves are just not particularly interesting. And it almost like it revels in being a cryptic mess. You know, I don't want to figure it out. You know, I don't know. It's pretty.
It is pretty.
It's pretty.
Did we talk about Southern Bastards 4?
We might have. I don't know. I can't remember. But I tell you, that fourth issue, man, I was really at odds with a lot of people around there, because, okay, these are spoilers, okay, because we're going to talk about the ending to this thing. And I know you didn't like it, because he pulled some similar writer's tricks that he did in Scalped about how he deals with the protagonist and some stuff. And I don't like getting the rug pulled out of me. I mean, I can handle it, but let me tell you, when a dude goes back to his small town and he wants to settle his father's house And he goes to his father's grave. I mean, his father's like this Buford Pusser type sheriff that existed 20 years ago, right?
Right.
And put, you know, and put these racists down and restored law and order or whatever it was. And he did it with a bat. And this guy goes to his father's grave, and there's this fucking oak tree growing out of his father's grave. Now, symbolically, I think this is supposed to be a good thing. I don't know. I don't know enough fiction, but I think when a tree grows out of your grave, that's a positive thing. But when a lightning bolt hits the tree and one huge hunk of wood is left over woods that looks strangely enough like the bat your dad used to kick ass, and you get this thing, I'll call it, for lack of a better term, the God Bat, okay? The guy gets the God Bat. Now, he goes in there and probably beats the shit out of 24 guys half his age, okay? The guy's 60, I'm thinking, 65, I don't know. And to go through all that shit and lose and die is just, it's horseshit. You can die in the attempt to rectify a situation. But when you go through all that and the old man gets up and kills you and the God Bat doesn't mean anything. I mean, the God Bat doesn't mean shit. He got the God Bat from heaven, I think, from his dad or whatever. I don't know. But it didn't mean shit. I was like, well, why do you introduce all this stuff and then not mean it, make it worth shit at the end, you know? It just pissed me off. I don't know.
I think we have talked about this before, but Vernon's still pissed off, everybody.
I am still pissed off. You know, I mean, I could handle scalped reversing or switching your protagonist because at least he comes up with an interesting protagonist in Scalped at the very end, you know, because
right.
He did one for the other. And I actually, you know, he switches roles between the protagonist and antagonist in Scalped. And he makes the antagonist a semi-noble being that you have some admiration for. But all I can say is if you get the God Bat, you're supposed to win. And and even if you die, you're supposed to win, okay? I don't know. These are like mythological must-haves for me. I don't know. But Jason Aaron pissed me off. And then what is it? Like a week after this issue, his Marvel Icon book called Men of Wrath, which is yet another angry old man commits murder and kills people book. And I'm like, oh, boy, I can't do it. You know, and we select Ron Garney as an artist, and Ron Garney's just hacking it out these days. I don't know. But Jason Aaron's got something to prove. I hope to God he's getting some good checks at Marvel because I can't read his shit anymore. Sad but true.
All right. Next up, we're doing trades. So what is it? We got Cowl, which is actually turning out to be a nice little book.
Yes.
It's hitting its bumps, but you know what? That's not bad, all things considered.
No, it's a book that needs a little bit of special attention. The artist is a bit of a Bill Sienkiewicz wannabe, but he gets through it. He can do the narrative. You pay attention, you'll figure out the characters, you'll do fine on it. And the first trade is out on that, and it's a nice little trade. I mean, at $9.99, Image is very competitive with their books. And the story of the Chicago Police Department and the Chicago Heroes Union back in the 60s is a involving story. And in the first arc, he establishes a lot of characters and a lot of conspiracy and a lot of underpinnings that provide for a very interesting story. And that's a nice collection you should pick up for, especially for $10. Jesus. How about that sequel? Now, if we talked about the sequel to Battling Boy that came
out.
Now,
you've been trying to get me to read it, and I still haven't. Yeah.
You know what? The Rise of Aurora West is actually a prequel. Because it talks about Aurora West and her being raised by her father to – he doesn't raise her to be tough. He raises her to survive and deal with the psychological problems of being a good person in a world of really crazy villains that will not hesitate to kill you if you give them the opportunity. And it's darker than Battling Boy. It's scarier than Battling Boy. And yet – Aurora West is a much more developed character than Battling Boy.
And, well, to be fair, Battling Boy was coming to the world and to get established. I mean,
right. And Aurora West is a young lady, which it's always nice to have female protagonists that are really strong. And they do it in this kind of manga format, which talks about her and her dad. I guess there are a couple of his hired people. Like he's got this one badass chick who trains Aurora and keeps an eye on him while he's gone crime fighting, you know, and then eventually he brings her along and gets her involved. And you know, what's really nice is in most of these books where you see like the young sidekick being trained to take over or at least be part of the team, he doesn't just stop there. He talks to her about the maturity involved and how you have to handle the psychological problems that come with being a fighter of psychotic beings and stuff like that. And it's a really nice piece of work. And some people said it's a little scarier because I guess it's semi intended for some young audiences, but it's got some uniquely spooky parts in it. But you know what? It's not as nasty as Harry Potter, for Christ's sakes. And this guy, David Rubin, who I guess Paul Pope either handpicked or found to take over the art on this, is really, really good. I mean, the guy's drawing skills are good. He's semi-cartoony, but there's never a lighthearted moment that you mistake for cartooniness or light humor, even though some of the characters are shall we say, wistfully drawn. It's very tightly constructed. And you know what? It's probably one of the better graphic novels out on the rack right now. I mean, for another one for $10, $9.99. I mean, it's an absolute steal. And you could do a whole lot worse than taking a look at this sucker. It's in black and white, which discourages some people. But, you know, when I hear people say, oh, I like black and white comics, then I stop talking to them because it's a waste of my time anyway. But she is a good character, and the things she goes through are great, and the lessons she learns are wonderful. It's a very good book.
Now, you want to talk about Kinski, but I did not get to read all of Kinski because when they sent these
PDF?
They sent the PDF. They sent the first issue, not the whole trade. So I will be getting caught up on Kinski. It's available from, I think, Thrill Bent or one of those online comic places.
Right.
So I will be getting a hold of that.
Yeah, I would have to say that Gabriel Hardman is one of the more interesting artists slash writer. I say he's mostly an artist. He's got really good chops. He's done an awful – one thing you say about one thing you can say about him is that Gabriel Hardman doesn't work on projects he doesn't like. I mean, we were introduced to him back in him and Jeff Lester's Agents of Atlas several years back. Not Jeff Lester. Who's our writer on Agents of Atlas? It's not Jeff Lester.
Fuck. Jeff Parker.
Jeff Parker. Thank you. You and I love Jeff Parker's Agents of Atlas. And Gabriel Hardman was just a wonderful he's a great journeyman guy who knows how to throw himself into a project. He gives himself these little disciplined problems to figure out. And I think Kinski is an exercise for Gabriel Hardman exercising his chops as an artist. He takes a concept and he works it through in his head and he works it through in the art. And, you know, it's actually a very good educational experience for someone who's learning how to draw comics because he shows you in very simple terms how a comic works, what is necessary from panel to panel to keep the movement going, and what exactly is involved in structuring a narrative that people can understand. Now, you read the first chapter, right? I think there's five or something
there's
like
six,
that.
There's six, yeah.
Six. And he carries you along through the momentum. I'm not going to say Kinski is a work of high art because it's very rare to find an artist who can write as well as he draws. And it's more about the idea and him exercising this problem through his head of how to go from point A to point B throughout the six chapters. But he does it elegantly, and I think Kinski's a nice book. Although you are fooled by it because it gives you the idea that even though the dog is like the protagonist, it's not really about the dog. And he kind of fools you there. But Kinski's a nice, good, disciplined read, and I like that. I think that I'm going to be keeping an eye on Gabriel Hardman just because, I don't know, he's a damn good talent, and it's always good to see his work.
Yeah, now, I mean, I even read his Planet of the Apes at Boom.
Hey, you got to love fucking Planet of the Apes if you draw Planet of the Apes. That's all I can say, you know. And he had to be the best artist on that book, probably.
All right, so you wanted to talk about some blasts from the past as we wrap up here.
Yeah, what was it? On your blog, you have a tendency to, like, go and discover during slow times of comics publishing, you'll go and dig something you remember up. And I remember you had some pretty good hash with Firestorm recently until you got the 35th or 40th.
It gets slogging along.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know if comics should go to 45 or 50 issues. You know, I mean, you better have some inspiration to carry something 50 issues. That's and you know, the constant turnover of creative teams too doesn't hurt either, help either on a lot of books. But I discovered some really nice books. One of the first one is a reissue of some of Linda Barry's Ernie Pook's comic. Ernie Pook's comic was a syndicated strip that ran in the alternative newspaper, The Reader, which is it's in here in Chicago, and I think Los Angeles and a couple other cities carry it. It's a free alternative weekly, and they have syndicated comics of alternative cartoonists. Now, Linda J. Barry is a very eccentric one, and she went to Evergreen State University in Washington with the likes of Gary Panter and who's our Simpsons guy? What the hell is his name? Matt Groening?
Matt Groening.
Yeah, Groening. She is what I call the triumphant of comic artists. And Linda Barry has this, like, really – she uses her main character, Marlis, which is probably, I'm going to guess, like a 12-year-old girl. And I don't think that very few cartoonists can successfully capture the pain, the wonderment, the guilt of being a small child on the verge of teenage dumb like she does in her Marlis strips. They are sentimental. They are painful. They are tear-jerking. And all this within four-panel strips is a very hard accomplishment to pull off. Some people say, oh, the chicken scratching art hurts my eyes. I'm like, get over it. These are psychological strips about a young girl who is learning how to grow up despite horrendous classmates and growing up painful as a child in a very dysfunctional family. And this recent reissue from Drawn and Quarterly called Freddy Stories, it focuses on our brother, but Marley's in there as well, is just a seminal cartoon strip. It really is. I mean, probably one of the last of the great comic strips. I've yet to see anyone equal her in terms of honest, painful reminiscences of going through childhood. It's just great stuff. Another one I discovered was the next two, I should say, were picked up in collections that I bought over the summer, and I just put off to the side. And the next one is called Cherry Pop-Tart, Volume 1 by a second-generation underground cartoonist called Larry Wells. He's not as old as the old farts, but he started doing his stuff in the mid-70s. Now, Cherry Pop-Tart is this unabashed, X-rated strip about a hungry, horny, drug-induced teenager named Cherry Pop-Tart who will do just about anything. And what its saving grace is that Larry, while it's all humor, it's done in this Archie-type strip. And it is a gas in all the situations that Cherry finds herself in her pursuit of a good time and drugs and making love to her mom's pool boy and all sorts of fun things, you know. And it's a nice collection of the early Larry Welch stuff. And Archie was never this good or this fun. And I highly recommend it if you like good X-rated underground comics. It's just great stuff. Another one which is really bizarre. We're going to go 180 degrees here. And I'm going to go with The Best of Mystery in Space by DC Comics, which when DC Comics was figuring out their way in the late 50s, before they really got supercharged into superheroes, they had a number of science fiction writers like Gardner Fox, John Broome, and Otto Binder, who were science fiction writers. And while they were at DC, they concocted a whole load of 6, 8-page, 10 stories for their science fiction titles called Mystery in Space. And this book collects the absolute apex of the beginnings of the Silver Age for DC Comics. You're going to find Gil Kane, Carmen Infantino, Murphy Anderson, Sid Green, Mike Sikowski, Joe Kubert, some really odd choices like Virgil Finley and Frank Frazetta, and then Jim Mooney, of all places, before he went to Marvel, telling these absolutely wonderful, engrossing, short science fiction stories. At the beginning of their DC plan, I mean, you've got John Jones and Adam Strange and Space Cabbie and Atomic Knights. And these guys while there's a nice light touch in it, because they know they're doing children's comics, or should I say comics for older kids, let's put it that way, it's a wonderful collection of late 50s and early 60s seminal DC Silver Age strips. And man, I was just loving every minute of it. Strangely enough, it was published by Fireside Press. Is that right? Yeah. It wasn't published by DC, for crying out loud. So I guess they had better choice in their stories.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a better collection than DC comes up with. So God, I don't know where you'd find it, but if you find it, buy it and read it. Mysteries in Space, the best of DC science fiction stories. Great shit.
Yeah, I see it here. Yeah, it came out in 1980. Vernon's going back.
That's, you know, you find these old nuggets when you buy collections off the street. And, you know, you could do a lot worse. I mean, that's a funny thing. I mean, I'm 53, and I still discover new stuff, like, almost every week. That it's either old stuff that I never read, or new stuff, or foreign stuff, you know? So, again, don't read crap, because there's just so much good stuff out there, man. You know, fuck Batman, you know? I'm telling you, man.
On that note, what else do we...
I'm not sure I can top it, because we had some good stuff. You know, I mean,
we did.
It's kind of funny. Our shittiest comics on this podcast are far, far better than most of the stuff you'll find on the average comics rack at your average comic book store. So, I mean, Andrew and I can't say it enough that with involvement and paying attention to creators, you can find some really good comics out there, you know, and slap the clerk around at your local comic store. Get him to tell you what the good stuff is. And if he doesn't know, go shop at another store. That's all I can tell you. How about you? What are you up to now?
You know, I think you just topped it. And for anybody wondering when we recorded this, we just recorded it with the news that Jared Leto is going to be the new Joker. So
who's Jared Leto?
There you go.
well, I have a really hard time with that, like, ambitious schedule of DC movies coming out. I mean, Aquaman, really? How are you going to sell Aquaman to today's audience?
The guy's hot, Vernon, and he's going to be running around with his shirt off.
Okay, and what is he, like an angsty eco terrorist? Then he's
no.
Then he's,
it's going to be Aquaman the Barbarian.
Oh, okay. Then they're going to turn him into Namor the Submariner. Then right. Okay. Well, still sounds dull as dirt. Shazam. Okay. I don't know. You know, I mean, really? I mean, the Rock is Black Adam. I mean, okay, make him the star. I don't know.
Yeah,
at least Marvel movies have continuity between them, you know? DC movies just seems like they whip them out of their ass or something. I don't know. I can't figure it out. What are the new slate, do you say, looks promising on DC? Anything?
It's too soon to tell.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of like DC's Convergence. It's too soon to tell.
Too
we don't
soon
know
to
enough
tell.
Details.
Yeah, they haven't announced the creative teams on the movies, so who cares? Yeah,
exactly. You know, at least with Marvel, you know you're going to get something. It's going to come out on time, and it's going to follow the Marvel Universe and the continuity, which should make a majority of the moviegoers semi-satisfied at any rate, you know. But I don't know if I have those kind of hopes for Warner Brothers. They're just kind of pulling shit out of their ass here at the last minute. I don't know. Like their comic books.
Okay, on that note, Vernon has nothing else.
I'm spent, baby. Got my wad.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.
Yes, we will. And we'll have a new slate of comics and stuff that you should read.